to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to a special school board meeting this July 2nd at 2 p.m. Glad you are with us in the audience, and for those listening via the internet, with us this afternoon, we have school board member from District 3, Ms. Linda Cuthbert. On the far right, our agency clerk, Ms. Connie Spire. Next to Ms. Spire, we have from District 1, Ms. Jamie Haynes. Our vice chair of the school board from District 2 is Ms. Ida Wright. Joining us for his first school board meeting officially now as superintendent is Mr. Timothy Egner. Also with us today is our school board attorney, Mr. Ted Doran. And my name is Carl Persis, and I am the chair. Mr. Ruben Colon is on his way, and we will let you know when he arrives. Public participation time would actually be now if there's any public, and we do not have any public, so we're just going to move right on into our agenda, and it looks like it's item 3.01, Human Resources Update, Mrs. Dana Page Pender. We always are excited to hear the update on teacher vacancies and hires and where we are.
Okay.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Chairman Persis, board members, Superintendent Egner. I'll give you a vacancy and a fill report.
Okay.
Right now, as of this morning, because it's fluid, it changes just about every hour, there were 200 instructional vacancies out there. Of the 200, just over 170 were classroom positions. About half of that were at the elementary level. 20% of those were at the middle school level, and about 25% were at the high school level. 51 of those were ESC teachers.
51 of the
170 were ESC teachers.
And that would be elementary and
secondary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The remaining positions that were not classroom are academic coaches, intervention teachers, certified school counselors that are out there. As far as the fill, where we are, I know I've given you instructional, but I'll tell you support, because we're also processing support, and that's our transportation, schoolway, cafe, paraprofessionals. We had 86 that have cleared through the process on the support side, and about 45 that are in process. We have cleared 420 teachers into positions through the process. That includes transfers from school to school as well as new hires. There are 79 that are going through the screening process and 32 that are in the certification process. I do want to share that we have worked out a deal where we are very excited about a billboard on I-4. And so we are working on that. We just have worked through the process, and we've kind of vetted the message a little bit through Cabinet, and I will share it with all of you before it goes out so you know what to expect on billboard. We'll have a pretty quick turnaround, so when we get the proof in, it'll be about 24 hours when I send it to you, if you can send it back so that they can go through and produce it. But it will be just before 44 so that you can see it. We are trying to catch people that maybe had a great time in Central Florida and are thinking about relocating here. We want them to know that Volusia is a great place and teaching matters.
Did they give you an idea of what the traffic count was?
They did. I wanted.
They always do.
Yeah. It was well over 100,000.
Yeah.
And I do have that on my desk, but they did.
And, of course, the higher the traffic count, the more you pay for the billboard.
They were very gracious, I will say that.
Yeah, that's great. That's the way it works. Could you tell us, last time you were here, you mentioned a website or some other site to recruit. Have you had any hits on that one?
So we have, and we've used it for several positions. We actually are on two nationwide sites. We've been on Top Jobs for a few years now, and that's a nationwide site through EdWeek, and then Indeed.com. So we have a person who's working through that with the applications, and if you've not had a chance to go out there, I encourage you to go out there and click on it, and it will take you right into our vacancy site, but we do have a person who's walking everyone through that process, and we've been up for, I guess it was last Tuesday, so we've been up for about a week.
That's awesome. Can you give the board some assurance that as we get into this vacation month, if you will, that the human resources department will be functioning on all cylinders throughout,
and
no one's
going to
get lost in the system.
All 12 cylinders. We actually have a virtual job fair coming up with Ed Week towards the end of July, and we did have some success with that last year. But we are here and we are working hard.
Okay, great. Board members, questions for Ms. Dana Page Pender? And Mr. Colon is here, everyone. Yes, okay, yes. Mr. Colon.
Sorry about being a little bit late. Had a fire at work, but we got this to put out, not a real fire. So I know Mr. Egner brought it up during his interview, and so as we get closer to the school year, I noticed there's still 212 positions out there. And so I'd like to see that we are prioritizing, I guess this is more for you, where we're prioritizing ensuring that there are certified teachers in classrooms above all else, because as we saw with our results, we definitely have a lot of opportunities in these classrooms. And so as we move forward, because I've gone in and I love to Google, and there's a lot of districts doing some really creative things, including bringing folks from overseas to teach math and science. And so I think that we have to be creative in prioritizing that. Those are just my two cents. And I will also say I've spoken to several of my principals in the last few hours, and they're all praising the HR department and the work they're doing and the communication. So kudos to you for that. They definitely are feeling the difference. So
thank you.
Great. Ms. Cuthbert.
I have, as a secondary person, I'm always curious about the subject areas. Are there certain other subject areas that are needed than others?
I did pull ESC. I can send that to you. I have it. I didn't break it out for my report today, but I can send it to you. We can see exactly what they are.
Like science, math, algebra.
Off the top of my head, I don't write. ESC is the one that really jumps out.
Okay, no, that's just fine, but it's just a thing I'd like to know how well we're doing.
Always looking for science and math teachers.
And I heard English teachers, thank goodness, are now becoming the critical need. There's an R that comes down on English teachers, you know, but they're becoming a critical need as well. Okay, thank you. I appreciate the information.
Thank you, Ms. Cuthbert. Any other questions from board members? Mr. Superintendent, any comments?
To answer Mr. Colon's question, just to tell you what I've done so far, and I would very much like the opportunity at board meetings to give you a status report on what I've listed as my goals and objectives, and hopefully your goals and objectives were on the same page, and then what I've done to move towards accomplishment of that, or to the degree it's accomplished. I have been meeting with each and every department and reviewing their org chart top to bottom. I'm amazed at the quality work that's being done. I mean, I was so uplifted with the level of detail and the expertise of the professionals we have working here. And I did tell them that it was a priority to have certified teachers in the classrooms when school started to the degree possible. So everyone, I'm having second appointments with some of those departments in regard to unfilled positions and issues that are legally possible in regard to certified personnel being where they're most needed. They're needed everywhere. They may be most needed in a classroom. So we're making incremental progress on that. I have one position I know right now we're determining not to fill and instead move that back to a school. But that's a detailed report, and we're not prepared to elaborate. But what I can tell you is we're very definitively moving in that direction, and everybody in every department acknowledges that money most needs to be spent at schools, and they deserve staffing to the degree possible first. Not that these other positions aren't important, but there's a mission critical element to this. we understand the mission critical.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay. Thank you, Ms. Dana Page Pender, for that excellent report. And now we're moving on to item 4.01. This is a general fund preliminary budget report brought to us by Ms. Deb Muller, our Chief Financial Officer. Good afternoon, Ms. Muller.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman Persis and board members and Superintendent Egner. Good to see you all. So we were prepared to present this at last week's meeting. So this is the same presentation that was ready for last week. And there are three areas that we're going to be addressing in today's presentation. We'll quickly overview the FEFP, or the Florida Education Finance Plan. I know that we've brought that to you previously, but we'll do a quick review of that, as well as our staffing, where we're at in that process, and also the general fund reconciliation as it pertains to our revenue. Under the FEFP, this is the calculation that that goes through at the state based on the number of FTE students, and then each type of student provides a different type of program weight, which results in our weighted FTE students. That's used to calculate our total base funding, that factor along with the base student allocation and the DCD. So that is our base funding. That is really our most flexible funding, and that's normally what we concentrate on. But as you'll see, there are many other different categories and allocations within the FEFP, including what our required local effort is, which is our ad valorem tax levy, and comes down to the total state funding that we anticipate receiving. These next slides compare that funding for the conference budget, the 2019-20 conference budget, as compared to the 2018-19 fourth calculation, which is the most recent that we have received from the state. There will be one more final, which is the fifth. A couple of things to point out here. You can see where our unweighted FTE is on that first line. We are projecting a loss of FTE students for 2019-20. Although it's small, it does have an effect on our funding. You can see once the weighting is applied that we have a slight increase of 143.50 FTEs. And then we have our base student allocation, which is an increase of $75. Just to remind you that this past year, 18-19, I keep forgetting we're in July now, so forgive me if I wafer back from each year. But this previous year, we had a 47-cent increase. So, again, we were happy to see $75, although, of course, we would have liked to see much more than that and what the governor had recommended initially, because, as I said, this is our most flexible funding that we receive. So that's a 1.79% increase over last year.
Ms. Muller, yes. Would you, just for the listening audience, explain to everyone what when you say conference conference budgets and conference calculations, I'm sure people...
Certainly. The conference is actually the adopted state budget that comes out of the legislature. So once that is approved by the legislature and goes to the governor for signature, that's considered the conference budget.
Yeah. Thank you.
You're welcome. And then we have our DCD, which you can see increase ever so slightly for this year. And then you can see our school taxable value, which we have over $2 billion in increased value for next year from the previous year. And then our required local effort. So the required local effort is set by the legislature and is determined based on, number one, they allow for an increase on your new construction, but they are holding the increase in your current properties so that there is not an increase in the tax that's levied to the homeowners and the business owners. And just going quickly through the different categories, you can see the base funding is a $5.8 million increase. We also have some other categories I wanted to point out. Declining student enrollment, you can see, is up about 112,000. That's based on the 25% of the decline from last year to this year. You can see the Safe Schools funding, which you know is a priority by the legislature and the governor to increase that area for our safe school officers. And going to this next page, you can see this $989,000 decrease under digital learning. That money was eliminated from the budget and reallocated by the legislature to both the safe schools and the mental health allocation, in addition to some other areas. So that will be a big loss for us. We have some carryover, but looking forward to 2020-21 is we will definitely feel that hit in from losing that money. The mental health allocation was not as much of an increase as we hoped. Although it's a 7.98% increase, it's $118,000. But as you heard last week, we are making good progress with using those funds. So the big area here is the best and brightest teacher and principal allocation, which you can see was a zero figure for 2018-19. That's because that was allocated previously outside of the FEFP, so it was funded by the state and passed through the districts directly to teachers and principals. But this year, they've allocated it in the FEFP, so it actually looks like we are receiving a $6 million increase. That funding is directly related to that program, and I have some other information on that later. The funding compression allocation, there's a decrease of almost $700,000 there. And if you remember, that was a new allocation that was supposed to help districts that received less than the statewide average in total funding in 18-19. And that was to go away on July 1st of this year. But then the legislature changed the statute on that and allowed that to still be funded. And from what we had previously heard was that was directly related to the waves that people were making in relation to the DCD, but it is a little bit less than we received previously. The turnaround school supplement is a new category that used to be funded separately as Schools of Hope, and this is $500 per FTE for those identified schools. We have not received notification on the exact distribution of those pending grades and so on, but we will certainly let you know that information once we receive it. So the total FEFP here is an $11.6 million increase. And then we add back in the class size reduction funding and the lottery and our required local effort. And the total state FEFP is a $9.9 million increase of that total, or 3.65% increase of state funding. One thing just to point out is by reducing the required local effort, it shifts more funding requirements to the state. As they increase your funding, then it shifts some of that burden to the state. And the concern there that we've talked about statewide is that how much more can the state absorb as they continue to decrease that required local effort and shift it back to them. So we'll, I think ours is pretty low next year, and I'll show you that slide, but you can see that at some point I would think that they're going to have to adjust that RLE, the required local effort. So total funding at the bottom here is an increase of $13,172,004, or 2.95%. the combination of state and local funding. The total funding per student is an increase of $227.87. So our new funding per student for next year or this year is $7,420.20. And apparently our box on the top is smaller than the box in the camera. So I apologize for some of these that you can't see. Oh, look at the magic. If I had known, I would have asked sooner. This is just a bar graph of our full-time equivalent students, so the FTE. And again, this is just pictorially showing you the decrease of from the fourth calc of 62,102 FTE versus the 61,970 for next year. And again, that's our forecast. That is based on where we think kindergartners will come in. We've kept that pretty flat as a projection and as we roll all of our students up. So as you know, we'll be looking at the 20-day count as that starts to come in, because that will affect our funding once that gets adjusted to actual numbers. So, you know, the last few years, as you can see, we've been decreasing in student counts. We did have a spike at one point that offset our decline a little bit because we had students that were displaced from hurricanes a couple of years ago. But we don't really see any projected increase in this enrollment until a couple of years down the road. And as you know, we've talked about the fact that Volusia is growing older as compared to the statewide average, that we're growing older faster. But it also varies based on birth count every year. And this, again, is just the base student allocation. And I've actually taken off 2007-08, which was the highest amount prior to the recession. So you can see during the recession where we started low and we've been gradually keeping up. You know, the largest issue with this is we just haven't kept pace with inflation. And this is what really hurts us when it comes to providing salary increases, benefits, and all of the other costs that we face on an annual basis that are increasing in our school district. And this is what I had spoken briefly about before, the history of the required local effort. And you can see that ours is projected to drop down below 4% in the general fund for next year, so 3.856. And that's a projection right now. It will be finalized in July, coming up in when we present our tentative budget. And you can see the tax roll increase. Obviously, during the recession, we had all those losses. But we continue to see a strong increase in our tax roll. And this is another snapshot of the DCD, the district cost differential, and the total losses that Volusia has seen since 2004. Over $160 million we are at now. And you can see those districts that have been the beneficiary of those offsets. And the interesting thing is that there really are fewer and fewer districts that are benefiting and more districts that are dropping below that 1.0 DCD and actually seeing money being taken away from them. And this is just another view. This is our year-by-year loss over here. For 2020, it's $10,038,553, which is $161.99 that we lose per student based on that DCD number. And this is our FTE total per student funding. I had told you before that there's the new rate is $7,420. The lighter blue line and marks are actually the statewide average, and I know you can't see that above there. Our average is, our increase, I'm sorry, is $228 per student. Let me just tell you. $263 is the statewide average increase. So, again, Volusia is consistently, because of the DCD, below that statewide average, and even at some points widening, even though there's the compression allocation that we've been receiving the last 2 years, you can still see that our gap is higher next year than it was last year. And just a little bit, as I had mentioned, on the best and brightest teacher principal bonus allocation, I know organizations all over the state during the legislative session were asking that this money be used to fund teacher salary increases instead of bonuses. In the end, what we did receive was a bonus program. But just to show you how that affects our funding, we have a total FEFP increase of $13 million. If you subtract out the best and brightest of $5.9 million, that leaves our total funding increase, net of the best and brightest, at $7.3 million. Just to give you a relational example of that, $6.4 million is the cost of our salary increases, 2% district-wide. So that's just a little bit more than a 2% salary increase.
Repeat the number again, please.
Yes, 2.4%, or I'm sorry, 6.4% increase in salaries. I didn't say that right again.
Yeah.
$6.4 million is a 2% salary increase.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And that works out to $95.24 per student loss because of this best and brightest. So our real funding increase per student without the best and brightest is $132.62 per student. And we haven't gotten definitive information on what the best and brightest will look like, but basically it is to address three areas: recruitment, retention, and recognition. So the recruitment will be a one-time bonus up to $4,000 for newly hired teachers who are content experts in these areas. Neither of those are defined in law. And then retention is a little bit more complicated. It's based on being highly effective, being in the same school for two consecutive years, and then improved 3 percentage points or more in the total possible points achieved. So, you know, we will be working on that. I know that we'll be getting guidance from the state. And then there are recognition awards for instructional personnel that are not just teachers, that are rated high effective or highly effective, and that will be based on some performance criteria. And the other piece of that is the principal bonus program, and they would have to have served as the school principal for the last four consecutive years, and then it's based on the average improvement of the school grades. Are there any questions before I move on to staff?
Questions? Yes.
Actually, I do. So Mr. going Cologne. Back to that principal area, so do they have to spend 4 years at the same school to get that bonus?
That is what it seems to say, yes.
Yeah. Wow. Because, you know, we tend to move folks around, and so arguably if there's funding available for folks to receive if they've been at the same school for 4 years, moving them would not allow them to, you know, to take part in that. That's
right. And I don't believe that we know at this point if it's it includes this school year, if this is the current school year, or last year is the current school year. So, again, we're waiting for more guidance from the state on that. I know that has to work through, you know, DOE and the attorneys and the interpretation of the law.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Ms. Cuthbert.
I'd just like to expand on what Mr. Cologne said. So they have to have 4 years behind them. So it would be the fifth year that they're at the school that it would be considered, correct?
Again, I'm not certain that's something, yes, that we're not.
And then also it says rated highly effective or effective for teachers who had to work in the same school for two consecutive years. So it's not eligible for a new teacher for the first 2 years.
Correct. Those are... Those would be, the recruitment bonuses.
Uh-huh.
But the first year, you know, a teacher would not have, as far as performance pay, they would not have a score if they were new. It looks like it takes 2 years before they would be eligible.
Okay. And then that best and brightest money is not divided into so much for principals and so much for teachers. It's whoever qualifies and how we have to. It's, I guess, up to the district to determine?
I believe so, not that I have seen. And again, you know, some of, obviously, the recruitment bonuses will be determined on the number of teachers that you actually hire based on your need in those specific areas. I know the retention bonuses have already been available to teachers based on whether they're effective or highly effective, and their ACT, SAT score. So that was removed from the law. And so this seems to be more consistent with how the school grade is faring as well as their consistency and their evaluations. But I don't, I have not seen that it's split up specifically for principals versus teachers, but it may be.
Okay, and what if we have, let's just, no principals, but all teachers. But we have more teachers eligible for the $2,500 bonus and the $1,500 mm-hmm. bonus or the $1,000 bonus than the money we have.
It will be prorated.
Be prorated.
Yes, that I do know. It's not here on my slide, but that money could be prorated based on the number of eligible teachers.
Okay, so the mm-hmm. ones who are eligible are going to receive a bonus.
Yes.
Okay, it just may not be the... $2,500. Okay, and I suggest that before these are given out, that information needs to go
yes,
out.
Yes, yes. HR definitely works with teachers and publicizes all of that information prior to any of this ever being given out normally.
Okay.
They're well aware of what it is. The other area which we've been allowed to do in the past is even though it says $2,500 bonus, we're allowed to take our payroll taxes out of that. So the district would have to pay FICA on that. And so we would deduct that first. So the $2,500 would be less the FICA that the district is responsible for. So it's not even the full $2,500. And that's been the case for the last 2 years. So I think that, you know, that's confusing to some people because then they see that their gross bonus is not even the amount that is stated. So we do, I know that they do a good job of communicating that and making sure that teachers are aware and let them know that they have to communicate that to them if they're eligible.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Further questions? My only question is related back to the principal bonus allocation. It looks like that would come under the retention criteria bonus in terms of either $2,500 or $1,000. I'm not sure. They don't mention a particular dollar amount for the principal one. I don't know if that's forthcoming or is that also one of those, depending on how many teachers qualified first and then whatever's left and prorate it.
The information that I had did not state the amount, but I can try and find that out.
Sure.
I think... if I remember correctly, the last year's amount was $4,000 or $6,000.
Okay.
Was somewhere in there.
Be interesting to see. All right. Yes, Ms. Cuthbert, go ahead.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
The recognition awards, that would be for non-instructional personnel, not just teachers. That would include a para or a media specialist?
It could be. This is really the section of the statute that is clear as mud. at this point in time. So we are awaiting to see what the criteria will be to determine that. And if there's no money left from after these other awards are given out, then there would be no additional funding. But that is what we're anticipating, is that any other staff within the school may be eligible. But again, awaiting DOE information.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, you can move on.
Okay, so our staffing plan, just to bring you up to date on a couple of formula changes that we made for next year. We previously had, if a school had 300 to 849 projected students, they would receive an 11-month TOA. This year, for any school that has more than 300 students, would receive an AP instead of a TOA. And then schools with EBD and with EBD programs and multi-VE, they would receive a TOA, a 10-month TOA in their school to help with the discipline, because what we're seeing is a lot of the assistant principals are handling discipline instead of evaluating teachers and being out in the classrooms assisting with instruction. So because we have a feeder program of ESE, you know, and so they're concentrated in certain schools, that's four schools already had those TOAs in place, and so we did change the formula. That was a request from the ESE department to assist with those schools. And then the other change is high school TOA. And although this is a change in the formula, previously we kept making an intervention for these. So it's not really a staffing change, but instead of making an intervention every year, we just made this the formula. So any high school that has less than 2,500 students receives a 10-month TOA. The only two schools that were always affected by this were Atlantic and Taylor Middle High School. And so although Taylor has more than 2,500 students, or has less than 2,500 students, but they also have the middle school as well as the high school, which complicates their schedule and so on, that we would always give them a TOA as an intervention, not as part of the formula. So we've just changed that to make that the formula. And then there's no changes in the staffing units formula for allocating any instructional core and non-core.
Ms. Mueller, go back to your previous...
Ms. Wright, please. Yes.
Thank you. Right there, so you're saying where it's the one TOA, that is for Atlantic, and two is for Pearson Taylor?
No, the less than 2,500, that's Taylor and Atlantic.
And the one greater than, where are they?
That would be the other schools. But, again, this was already in practice, but it wasn't a formula. So we just changed the formula to match what we did every year.
And may I add to
Ms. Cuthbert?
Mrs. Wright, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So the high schools over 2,500 are University, DeLand, and Spruce Creek High School?
Well, we have, I believe... Yeah, let me restate that, because I think there may be four high schools, excuse me now, that are over that, but I don't have the enrollments in front of me.
Okay, maybe mainland? I'm not sure. Okay, but I know those three, for
mm-hmm.
sure.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Yes. And based on our formulas, this is our school-wide average history for our students in 2018-19 and previously. And again, back in 2016-17, the law was changed to allow the calculation of school-wide average versus class-by-class average students. But as you can see, when we made a change to our staffing at that point in time, the averages have not been affected. You know, some of it depends on the size of the classes and how they flow through from pre-K through secondary. But you can see that they're pretty consistent with previous years. So we, you know, when we initially made that change in staffing back here, we added one under primary and intermediate, and then under core in intermediate and second, we increased that by one student per FTE staffing unit, and we haven't really seen that that has been an issue in increasing our staffing size or our school-wide averages.
Ms. Cuthbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Non-core, are you talking about academy courses?
It would be anything defined as non-core courses.
Okay, core would be math, science, English, and social studies. So you could have non-core academy class with 39 students in it.
Yes.
That has
been consistently our formulas. We did not change those.
Yes. I know it, but it's still a lot of kids. When you're handling tools or computers, it's just a lot of space, especially with the new restriction on class size, dimensions, physical dimensions, to squeeze a lot of kids in with one teacher, with 39.
And I do know when we look at class sizes, we do look at those numbers. You know, Stephanie Workman does a really good job in looking at, well, when she's helping to build those schedules with the data APs and really looking to make sure that the class sizes aren't over and then they balance. And I know that goes through a progression, you know, as we start seeing students come and moving kids around, and I'm really not the person to give you all of that information because I really, you know, it's more from a staffing. This is more of a staffing formula, but doesn't necessarily translate to actual class sizes. Okay.
Yes, but it's possible that they can be. The master schedule could show 39 students in those courses. Is it possible that we could, based on last year, how many students were in these non-core at the intermediate and secondary levels in the non-core classes?
In the non-core.
I mean, yes. Mm-hmm. I would like to know how crowded they really are, especially when we have certification classes. And we're very proud of our students who graduate with four-year academy degrees.
And I know a couple of years ago we did pull that information. You know, I don't believe that the majority of the non-core classes are that large, but, you know, you would see that in some of them. But this is a staffing allocation. It's not necessarily what you would see class by class in every course.
Yes.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Colon.
So I guess it's more directed to the superintendent. When I think of this formula, I think of Forest Lake, and Forest Lake is a tough school. They've got EBD there. And so just for the sake of our conversations that we've had already, you know, we really need to look at, you know, I can tell you that Dr. Narig spent his whole life chasing kids because there were just not enough bodies on campus. And we ended up adding a TOA in the school later on in the year, but even still, you know, when you've got children who are, you know, who tend to elope and run around, which you can't touch, they've been very, very challenged there. And so I think there are some scenarios that we need to look at, you know, where I realize we have a staffing formula, there may be a need for additional assistance in those special circumstances, because You know, I think back to the picture we received not long ago. Our teachers are getting hurt in these scenarios. And so, you know, maybe a TOA seems like what we would see as a solution, but maybe that principal would rather have two paras in the place of that TOA because what they need is someone to be boots on the ground. And so, you know, that's not necessarily directly related to budget, but just something since we're talking about staffing.
Go ahead. If I may, I think your observation is keen in that regard. I am used to a culture where the principal is basically the CEO of their school, and when they get by formula allocation, they then have an opportunity to make a case for some type of discretionary action or differentiated staffing on the basis of some set criteria. So in keeping with your train of thought, I'm working with staff, and it's going to be a goal, to come up with some type of criteria whereby if we have a discussion, a staffing discussion for an intervention or discretionary allocation, that it meets some kind of criteria that we can all agree to. It also can mean, and again, Ms. Cuthbert, your reference to classes, all of us who've been teachers had those situations where there might be 50, 60 kids in a PE class and 12 in another class. Some of the non-core classes, enrollment is limited by the number of seats in the lab, for example. So is being referenced here is we'll get you the numbers on that, but you almost have to look by type of course and you have to look by facility to get a good answer. To give you a reference, when I first started teaching American government and economics, I taught in an auditorium with 75 students because I could and because other people needed the classroom and they needed a smaller class size. Having lived this, I'm sensitive to it, so we always have to keep an eye on that. The formula is one thing. How kids learn is another thing, and we have to blend the two.
And to complement...
Yes, Ms. Cuthbert, go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Advanced placement is considered non-core, isn't it?
Yeah, and most of the rules don't apply to those courses, I might add. In regard to class size and things of that nature. Ironically, it used to be that frequently to be able to start a third-party assessed college program, that you might have to start it with six kids and grow it. And so you were often given one of those discretionary permissions to run it for much less than you normally would. The world changed with class size. And I've seen many examples where the core class, standard level core class, was highly regulated, and then the AP class might be the one that has 40 kids in it. It is considered non-core and an exception to most of the rules in regard to staffing allocations.
Ms. Wright.
So I have another question. So listening to my colleague, Mr. Cologne, I assume you're talking about maybe an EBD program?
Yeah.
Okay. And so when you start having these conversations, will EBD be to the table? Because
yeah.
I think they may have a totally different view. All programs should not be at all schools. Some principals are better with the programs. Some teachers are better with the programs. Do they have a say in who actually work in the program? Because I think that, too, can be one of the challenges. I think they would probably be better suited to say, you know, this person really have the degree but really do understand this population versus someone who may be certified in ESC but may not have that skill set for EBD. So do we include them in these types of conversations? And I know this is off budget.
Right. We're getting into another area right now.
I just wanted to add to that because, as you know, we have our class size meetings, and we do look at those classes as well. That would be, and I don't know if Kim Gilliland is here, but she's always at the table, and we do take a look at those classes, and you know, she has the ability to recommend additional staffing, like a behavioral specialist. Those decisions are not made by budget at all. those are definitely instructional conversations, but we do have those discussions at the class size meetings, and as well as with other classes, you know, especially in elementary, looking at individual grade levels and where, you know, maybe a school expected they would have this many first graders and a number of them left, and so they don't need that teacher that they thought they would need. Or and then in second grade, more kids in second grade showed up, so they may flip-flop, or, you know, there may be combined. And it also depends on the identification of the gifted classes, you know, which that happens throughout the year or the early fall. So it really is a fluid situation, and that is why we do meet and we discuss and review each school as needed, and principal requests. We talk to the area. We have the area superintendents there as well as curriculum, and sometimes ESOL. You know, there will be a higher identified need for ESOL. So we bring all those people to the table and have those discussions. But, you know, ultimately we would refer any questions or any decisions that we didn't feel comfortable making or were in disagreement to the superintendent to have those conversations as well.
Sounds good. Okay, I think you were on slide 24 or getting ready to go to 24.
Okay, so this is a summary of the preliminary school staffing changes, and I would be happy to, you know, share the details behind that with you. But just so you can have an idea, and you can see in the teacher units where the staffing that we brought to you that was actually adopted increased by 12.4 units from adoption to the end of 18-19. So those were actually physical units that were approved to be added to the budget to staff the schools. And then this year, the net is a loss of 4.9 teaching units. And one of the reasons for that is we actually had, to break it down a little bit, is we had 6.4 core units that it decreased, and then we had six ESE units that for fiscal year 18-19, we had 6.4 more core units and six ESE units that were added. So that's the 12.4. And then in 19-20, we had a reduction of 18.2 core units by formula, but we added 13 ESE teachers by formula. So those are just, you know, big numbers that encompass the entire school, and we have those by school that we can certainly provide to you. But that, you know, we have seen an increase of like 17% to 18% in identified students under ESE. So we did see a large increase in the ESE units that we provided. And the adjustment to some of these is a result of last year our enrollment didn't come in as high as we had projected. So we did pull back some units as well. You can see in the paraprofessionals, though, the 16.8 position increase between adopted and the end of 18-19, and then another 23 units for next year. So that's, again, a reflection of the formulas under the ESE. And down below where you see the athletic directors, where we had previously had a 0.5 unit for athletic directors at the high schools, that's been increased to a 1.0 in each school. And then the APs and the TOAs, you can see some of those are just adjustments based on the formulas, and some are based on the changes in the formula that we discussed.
Yes, Ms. Wright.
Why did we go from a 0.5% to a full or for athletic directors?
That was a request that came to me from Mr. Russell.
Okay, you may continue.
May I ask?
I didn't know you had a hand up. Ms. Cuthbert.
Where would the Academy facilitators be in here?
I believe those would be in the... I think those are in the, those are actually in the teacher units.
Teacher. So does that mean it's at a high school principal's discretion that to have that facilitator?
No. No.
Okay. But that's, so that's included in one of the high school units.
Yeah, those are allocated through CTE.
Okay.
But they're included in those teacher units.
Okay, I think up till last year it was half a 0.5. Are they still sitting at a 0.5 or have they gone to 1.0?
They are 0.5.
They're still 0.5. Mm-hmm. So if a high school wants to have that facilitator at 1.0, would have to give a half, has the discretion to do that half, 0.5, that to come away from somewhere else?
We actually have limited that to just a 0.5.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And this is the summary of preliminary department staffing changes in the superintendent's office. And again, we discussed this when we came before you with the board workshop. The increase of 5 units for next year is actually the attorney that was included in the budget because his department falls under this, as well as a reclass of 4 units that were under technology services that are just being reclassed under community information. So it's not an increase. It's offset by a decrease under operations, but because operations has numerous departments, that entire staffing area is a decrease of 1.0 units.
Yes, Ms. Haynes.
So, yes, you did talk about reclassifying 4 of those positions from TS over to the superintendent and taking them out of operations, but yet operations only shows a decrease of 1 position for this coming year.
Right, that's because it's a net. We have, let me look at the detail here. We have 3 painters that were requested. A 1.0 choice specialist, a network technology person, an SIS specialist for the student information system. But then we have, and we also had the increase for the customer experience person. We have elimination of 2 USA 3 positions, elimination of technology network systems and monitoring, a program analyst, and then the other ones are reclasses that are going from operations into the community information.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
And you had asked about the safe schools and what that staffing would look like next year, so we have an increase in the budget of $357,513, and we're still in negotiations with some of these agencies, but for fiscal year 20, we anticipate having 9 Volusia County Sheriff's Deputies, 11 Daytona Beach SROs, which is the current number that we have, as well as the 2 DeLand PD SROs, the 1 South Daytona and the 1 Ormond Beach SRO. And as I said, we're still in negotiation for those final costs there, as well as the Ormond Beach Police Department is, we didn't have to pay up until this point, but that is coming off the COPS grant. So they had their final year that ends September 1st, and so now the district will have to absorb some of that. We did eliminate 4 deputies mid-18-19, as you know, that were replaced by guardians at middle schools and the High Banks Learning Center. And then there will be an additional 4 deputies that are eliminated in 19-20 that are moving to SRO or to guardians at Galaxy Middle, Heritage Middle, Holly Hill, K-8, and River Springs Middle. And then there are additional guardians being added as per the recommendation of the state to have additional safe school officers per 1,000 students at high schools. So we're adding a guardian at Atlantic, Deltona, Pine Ridge, and Seabreeze, in addition to the SROs that they already have. And then the one substitute guardian position will be increased from 185 days to 250 days to assist with plans, weapons, inspections, and training, and so on. And that will all be paid for by the Safe Schools allocation.
Ms. Haynes.
So last year when we decided to eliminate four of the deputies, mm-hmm. I know that they looked at school-wide data for the schools that they selected that first round, including High Banks, Creekside, New Smyrna Beach Middle, and Silver Sands. So was data once again looked at this year to select which middle schools we would move guardians to and eliminate the deputies?
I know that there were discussions on that. I think Mr. Aiken could give you more information regarding that process. I think, as he had said before, that was actually a request of the Sheriff's Department to decrease the number of school resource deputies because of their shortage. But I know that there was data was looked at.
Well, because I was in support of it, and I think it went very well. Mm-hmm. I know at least two of those schools, the guardian was even a lot more visible than what the sheriff's deputy had been. Mm-hmm. So I'm in favor of it. I just didn't know because, not that I'm asking, but like Southwestern is one of my schools, and it's a smaller mm-hmm. middle school, mm-hmm. but yet we're still leaving a sheriff's deputy at Southwestern, and so I just wondered if the discipline data was looked at to make mm-hmm. the decision.
Why don't we let Mr. Aiken come forward and somebody else may have a question for
him. I'm telling you, the guardians are doing a phenomenal job out there.
Good afternoon, Mr. Aiken.
Good afternoon, Chairman Persis, board members, Mr. Eichner. Ms. Haynes, yes. So Greg Aiken, Chief Operating Officer, yes, we looked at all the data, not just the referral data from the school vandalism report. We also looked at any report that the SRO or SRD did while they were on campuses and made the determination which ones we would keep this current year. And so Southwestern is one of those based on the numbers that we reviewed.
Okay. So you felt it was best to keep a sheriff's deputy at Southwestern instead of changing to a guardian?
Yes, this year. And so we're going to be reevaluating that as we move forward with this following year.
Okay.
Mr. Cologne.
So at DeLand, is that two SROs at DeLand High School?
So we would have one Volusia County Sheriff's Department and one guardian at DeLand High. Is that what you're asking? And then are you talking about the two deputies? We have one at DeLand High School, one at DeLand Middle School.
Okay. And so
the sheriff.
So there's no mention of adding an SRO to DeLand High.
So we have a Daytona Beach PD. DeLand PD has two officers, one at DeLand Middle, one DeLand High School. We're going to add a guardian, what we already did, but we didn't have one last year at DeLand High School.
So we're adding one, okay, because that's
yes.
not on here. Okay,
yeah.
Great. I just wanted to make sure because I know.
Yes, the substitutes.
Right.
That, yeah.
It was included last year. We just didn't hire that person because we didn't have the candidate go through the training. This year, they're in the training starting Monday.
So the substitute is going to be the DeLand High second person?
So we're going to have one SRO, DeLand PD,
right.
and our guardian there. That guardian gets pulled if we have a vacant, absent person in the DeLand area. That guardian would be pulled to go there for that day and then go back to DeLand High.
And so my concern with that is we had a lot of incidents at DeLand High
sure
this
did.
Year. And so the thought that we would use, rather than keeping that SRO there mm-hmm. all the time because of the high level of incidents that we had there, my concern is that their need may be higher than there's always going to be somebody sick.
True.
And the thought that we're going to expand this person to go across the county, yes, they're the substitute. That means they're not going to be at DeLand High where they need to be.
So we have other substitutes as well. So we probably wouldn't pull them from there.
Okay.
We have one at University High School, DeLand High School. Now we're going to have one at Deltona High, Pine Ridge High School, right? So we'll have four on the west side of the county that we can pull. So if we have the fifth one, then we would pull somebody else from the east side to come to the west side. Does it make sense? So we would definitely monitor the behaviors on the campus before we would pull one of our what we call sub-guardians. They're permanent employees at the high schools to help with the work hand-in-hand with the SRO or SRD. Only pull them if needed at another location.
Great.
Right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good questions. Okay. Moving on.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Aiken.
And I think just I know that there are, I believe, 13 guardians that will be going through the program for replacements and or new guardians. And just a snapshot that I like to include here because I think it does, you know, have an effect on our population and our schools, that we have an increase in 1920, again, in our free and reduced lunch percent, and we do have an increase in our Title I allocations and a decrease in the number of identified schools. And I know that you're, you know, aware of the change in allocations, but I did want to just include that for your information. Then we have the general fund reconciliation to the conference budget. And so bringing forward in 18-19, we had a $3.21 million deficit that we used fund balance for to balance our budget, because we do have to submit a balanced budget. Our conference report revenue, the FEFP, which we just looked at in that first section, is an increase of $13 million. Then we have earmarked categoricals, and those earmarked categoricals that are not general revenue, they are for safe schools, mental health, the best and brightest, and the turnaround schools. So the total of those funds is $6.97 million. So we need to deduct that out of our revenue. We also will have a loss of E-rate revenue of $1.2 million. And in 18-19, we had a fourth calculation loss of $2.62 million. And then we have an additional capital transfer, which is an increase for a net loss that we need to balance the budget of $520,000. Looking at the appropriation side of the budget, district-wide, we have a $4.03 million increase. The detail for that, as you can see here, is the salary lapse. So that is actually a positive amount, that we have $4 million additional projected in salary lapse. We have $930,000 in a health insurance increase projected. A retirement rate increase, that rate is set by the legislature, so projecting that out to our employees is an increase of $700,000. And then the raises of 2% is $6.4 million. So district-wide, that increase is $4.03 million. Looking at the school-wide increases, that's $2.72 million. And these are based on the staffing changes that we just went through. The additional staffing that was added after the 18-19 budget was adopted at a cost of $1.35 million. And the increase for this year is $960,000, as well as the fact that we are increasing the elementary school day by 30 minutes. So all of those paraprofessionals that are assigned to elementary schools will be working an additional half hour, except for the 8 hour, that we do have some 8 hour paras, so obviously they will still be working 8 hours. So that increase is $2.72 million. Looking at specific projects, there's a decrease of $1.77 million, and that is mostly due to teacher retirement savings of $1.9 million and the health insurance request for proposal that we've budgeted for of $130,000. Looking at departments, we have an increase of $1.33 million, and that goes back to the positions that were added during 18-19, their position request for 19-20 of $390,000, some savings for non-salary requests of $110,000, and excuse me, non-salary requests for projects, an increase of $230,000, for a total increase in the departments of $1.33 million. And then other expenditures, we have an increase based on excuse me, charter school expansion and additional FEFP revenue that we have to pass through to charters of $980,000. We have, we have a savings of in telephones of $140,000, an increase in the projection for utilities of $930,000, and then the SIS maintenance and hosting fees, which actually is offset by a transfer from capital. So that's a wash, but is shown as an other item. So the increase in expenditures at this point in time is $8.39 million for a net needed to balance of $8.91 million. So I know before we looked at, we were looking at about $10 million. Obviously, we're still reconciling and making changes as they come about. So what effect does this have on the fund balance? Number one, I go back to what Mr. Egner had mentioned before, that he's looking at the org charts, looking at positions. Any recommendations will come either at the tentative budget or for the final budget, hopefully tentative, that we would bring back to you and outline those changes. But looking at our fund balance here, our assigned state and local at June 30th of 18 was $20.8 million. And if you remember, we had almost $6 million in our assigned fund balance that was a result of our health insurance refund. So you can see that that is no longer in that assigned fund balance. If you remember, so we went to the table to negotiate, and we used that money for bonuses, but we also used it for recurring salary increases. And so we have to make that up in the next year. If you look down in the unassigned, that changed from $27.6 million to just over $33 million. This is a preliminary number. We're still reconciling. Again, June 30th just ended, so there's a lot of adjustments and reconciliation and making sure that we've accounted for all of the 18-19 expenditures. And so our projection here is that if we have a $9 to $12 million budget gap and decrease in our assigned or unassigned fund balance, that we need to balance our budget for next year, we're looking at a remainder of $24 to $21 million in the unassigned. And so your goal as the board in unassigned is 5%. We ended June 30th of 2018 at 5.94%. And the projection right now prior to closing 2018-19 and finalizing the 19-20 budget is at 7.08%. That assigned subsequent budget would bring that down anywhere from 5.11% to 4.47%. You can see the financial condition ratio, which that's the total of assigned and unassigned fund balance, and that's what the state wants to look at, wants to see somewhere between 5 and 10%, a recommendation even higher. If you talk to GFOA, you know, anybody will tell you that you need to have that in your savings account for emergencies, but in Florida, that's not a realistic expectation in most districts. But in 6/30/19, we'll have 9.93 as the projection. So we're still within that range. And moving money in fund balance from unassigned to assigned does not affect your financial condition ratio. It's still in your fund balance that's calculated for state reporting purposes. And this is just a history of where those assigned or unassigned fund balances and the financial condition ratios have been for us. You can see that back in fiscal year 15. That was when we really started talking about the need to focus on our financial goals and to get that unassigned back up to 5%, your board goal, and when we were able to negotiate the health insurance cap, which we saw that that did cap the money that we were paying out for health insurance premiums on behalf of employees and drove that money into salaries. But we did see some savings when we did that. So, you know, we've been hovering above that 5%. So, you know, that you have done well in that regards and your direction to us. And we've maintained a pretty consistent financial condition ratio. So I guess the, you know, any other questions, concerns are where do we go? Do we use this fund balance to balance our budget or, you know, other direction that you would provide to the superintendent or he would provide for us to look at before bringing you the tentative budget in July?
So thank you very, very much. Ms. Mueller, for that update on where we are. At least it's a snapshot of where we are as of July 2nd and the projections for next fiscal year. So to recap, just at the end there, if we use our unassigned and assigned fund balance to balance our budget for FY20, then we would still be in within the state recommended ratios of 9.93%.
Yes.
Okay. Just wanted to make sure that that was clear.
Yes.
That we.
And again, this is preliminary. That's why I've kind of provided a range.
Granted.
Because we're still closing.
Granted. And let's hope that there's a lot of money that we had budgeted for things that we didn't need, and it's all going to come back in here in the next couple of weeks, and we'll be flush with money. Wouldn't that be wonderful, Mr. Superintendent?
Hope springs eternal.
It does here. It certainly does here. We've asked a lot of good questions. Are there any further questions for Ms. Mueller? And if not, let's take a 10-minute break, and we'll continue. All right, we are reconvening the meeting, and our next item on our agenda this afternoon is item 4.02, it's revised capital budget and five-year work program for fiscal year 2019-2020. And is everybody present to make the presentation? Yeah. Ms. Mueller, okay. Would you want to come forward, Ms. Morsi, and Mr. Glover just wants to make sure that we have the presentation today and we don't postpone it again, I think.
I have one slide and all the rest
are done. Oh, I see.
So
okay.
I'm starting to get nervous.
Ms. Mueller,
good afternoon,
good afternoon,
Mr. Chairman,
good afternoon.
And members of the board, Mr. Egner. With Ms. Mueller and I today is Mr. Jay Glover. I believe you've met him before, and he is our financial advisor. We're back after spending time together at Capital Budget Workshop, and we have a revised capital budget and five-year work program for you that we think responds to the comments that we heard from you. And I'm going to give it over to Deb. All right. Thank you again. Deb Mueller, Chief Financial Officer.
Welcome back.
Thank you. And actually, again, we had presented to you, just to kind of recap, we had presented a $75 million COPS borrowing for next year based on mostly Deltona Middle School identifying that as a project and wanting to move that up in the progress of our half-cent sales tax. So we went back, as Ms. Morrissey said, and looked at the numbers and moving projects around per your request. And we had Mr. Glover go back and run us some more numbers and see what that looked like. So what we came up with was $100 million borrowing. And he can walk you through those numbers and what that looks like from a borrowing standpoint, as I know that you'll want to know. Yeah. As soon as this moves. There we go.
Again, Jay Glover from PFM Financial Advisors, LLC. We're the district's financial advisor on debt-related matters. And as Ms. Muller said, we went back based on some work that your facilities people and Deb had done to look at what $100 million financing might look like, really based on the same credit structure we talked about before, which would be a COPS financing that would actually be paid back from sales tax revenues over a five-year period, again, emphasizing the desire to pay as little interest cost as possible and obviously save as much of the sales tax funding for projects. So as you see here on a slide in front of you, which should look familiar from what we had last time, this shows the key statistics of a $100 million financing paid back over 5 years. So your debt service coverage ratio based on sales tax revenues received as of to date is about 1.7 times. So there's still obviously plenty of sales tax revenues that are available to pay the debt service on this financing, as well as your prior financing done in 2016, and still have excess sales tax revenues available for pay-as-you-go, which we'll talk about on a subsequent slide. Again, issuance tentative date of October 1 of 2019. That date is flexible just depending on when the funds are needed. And we also weigh where interest rates might go. Obviously, we want to try to borrow at the most opportune, lowest interest rate environment. So if we see interest rates going up, potentially we might accelerate that. Or if the funds might not be needed as soon as that, we might delay. But again, the good thing about today's interest rate environment is you're borrowing at such low interest rates that you're actually going to be investing those proceeds while they're waiting to be spent at a rate that's really equal to or higher than your borrowing rate. So there's really no cost to holding those funds in hand, which is important, obviously, when you're talking about timing of a financing. Key statistics at the bottom of this slide, again, the par amount would be about $91.83 million, which would generate over $100 million worth of proceeds because bonds price at a premium in today's marketplace. And you'd pay back $5.8 million of net interest costs. So above and beyond the million you get up front, you're going to pay $5.8 million of net interest costs, or about $106 million of total debt service repayment. And this is based on an estimated interest rate of 2.0%. And I will also state that is a conservative interest rate in today's market. I think you'd probably be 15 to 20 basis points lower than that. But obviously, if we're not talking about financing something until October, we want to be a little bit conservative and hopefully come in lower than the figures we present here today. Moving on to the next slide, again, something you'll see. This is graphically what your debt service and excess sales tax revenues will look like. So going back to 2017, the orange bars here show your annual debt service on your 2016 financing that was $40 million. The proposed $100 million debt service is shown in the yellow bars, with the blue bars being your excess sales tax revenues above and beyond your debt service payments that would be available for pay-as-you-go financing. So on the far right side, you'll see, in addition to the $40 million and $100 million of bond proceeds for projects, you're also going to be generating about $493 million of excess sales tax revenues. And that really assumes modest to flat growth in sales tax revenues moving forward. So we think, obviously, that's a conservative figure of what would be available. Again, here on page 5, this is your debt service payments on the proposed financing. Your total debt service payment annually would be about $21.2 million, and you can see your total debt service is about $106 million. So, again, above and beyond the $100 million you get up front, you're just about $6 million of net interest costs paid back over the life of the loan. And then the final slide of my presentation just shows, again, what the debt service is on an aggregate basis when you include your 2016 financing, your proposed 2019 financing. You're seeing about $24.5 million of annual debt service for 5 years, and then it drops down to about $3.2 million thereafter that for the life of the sales tax. So what's important here is, again, this does a couple of things. It still gives you significant revenue for a pay-as-you-go basis, but it also gives you the ability, if you do come in 5 years from now and have another need to go through this process again, potentially to accelerate projects, you're going to have significant bonding capacity in that last 7 years to do another 5-year financing or a 7-year financing, or quite frankly, just have, you know, significant money on a pay-as-you-go basis. So this is still a fairly conservative financing structure that looks to minimize interest cost and also allows you to accelerate a couple of additional projects above and beyond, I think, the one we talked about last meeting. But that's not necessarily my department in terms of what schools get done. I'm just asked to provide what does the debt service look like, assuming we do these projects. And I'll turn it over to Deb and Sarah Lee to talk about sort of what this means in terms of your work plan in terms of schools getting done. And I'm happy to address any questions you all might have on this.
Mr. Glover, yeah, I noticed, though, in this in the presentation, there isn't any mention of ways we can invest the money, too. What, can you speak to that a little
bit? Yes, and that's a good question. I did hit on that briefly. So whenever you do a financing of this nature, just for illustrative purposes, you would get $100 million on day one when we close the financing. And obviously, that money is not going to be spent until, you know, 2, 3, and maybe even more time after that. So there is actually provisions within your borrowing documents that dictate how those funds can be invested. And they're generally invested in the most secure investments that are out there. They're invested in U.S. Treasury securities, or they're invested in some type of local government investment pool that's also rated AAA, such that you have, one, liquidity, because you obviously want the liquidity available to pay your project costs as they come about. You want safety, obviously. If you put $100 million in, you want to make sure you're getting $100 million out plus the interest cost on that. And then the last thing you look at when you're investing these proceeds is yield. So really, number one is safety. Number two is liquidity. And the third thing we look at is yield. And in today's interest rate environment, we have what's called an inverted yield curve. So short-term rates on the very shortest end of the yield curve are actually higher than rates out 2, 3, 4, and 5 years. So that was the point I made when I said, for instance, if you're borrowing at, say, 2% today for 5 years, if we were investing that money today, you could probably invest that money in excess of 2%, probably about 2.4% today. That investment rate is probably likely to come down over the next 6 months because the Federal Reserve has indicated their desire to lower short-term interest rates. So that will likely come down some. But again, over the next 3 to 5 years, you would think that while that money is being spent, you're likely going to earn, you know, the borrowing rate. You're likely going to, if you earn more than the borrowing rate, you're going to have to rebate back to the IRS. That's called positive arbitrage, and there's only certain limited assumptions when you actually keep that, and you have to spend your money very quickly to do that. But again, that's way in the weeds, but it's a big advantage of doing a financing in this type of interest rate environment, where you can actually borrow at a lower rate than the rate you're investing at. If you went back to when we did the 2016 deal, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but you were probably borrowing at 2.5% or 3%, and you might have been investing at 1%. And there was a time when you were investing at probably 0%. So really now is the opportune time. If you're ever going to take advantage of the capital markets and borrow money for projects, now is when I would recommend doing it, as opposed to maybe 5 years from now when you might have a different interest rate environment.
Thank you. I appreciate you telling us that second time. I just wanted to get it out on the record again. That's important information. Yes, Ms. Muller?
Okay, and our capital revenue assumptions, I'm not going to really walk through this because this has not changed from our previous slide. The only thing that we did do was talk about the bonding assumption, and in this scenario, it would be $100 million. And the Deltona Middle Master Plan is estimated at $55 million, but that was basically the reason for presenting bonding to begin with, because in the program, Deltona Middle would be pushed out for 3 years before we'd have enough funds on a pay-as-you-go basis to cover the $55 million that we would need. So these are, we can get into, you know, the details of what the budget would look like, but basically what we've changed is just the money is the same except for the $100 million and the debt service that would change based on this. And then we want to look at the five-year work plan and how that has turned around or how that has changed. And basically what it boils down to is this slide that Sarah Lee can discuss how she has moved the work plan around.
Ms. Morrissey?
The dollars that are reflected here are primarily the construction dollars. George Marks, there's no change from what we've shown previously. Deltona Middle, as I mentioned to you, we're working hard on that. We'd like to come back at July 22nd's workshop with the project team and do an update for you. But I have received some additional information from the project team, so that estimate right now is down from what you all saw at your workshop by $3 million. New Smyrna Beach Middle, now this is a project. It has not changed from what you all saw previously, so that $21 million reflects a phased project over several years. Osceola and Tomoka, those are the new projects. $24 million that is shown in fiscal year 21, those are the construction dollars and if necessary, a portable village. The design, the planning design dollars are shown in fiscal year 20. Those are $2 million. That's not reflected on your slide. The slide is reflecting the construction dollars, which is, you know, the big lump sum that is necessitating the change in borrowing. Tomoka, very similar to what I just described for Osceola. What we're doing is we're showing a 10% inflation from the costs that we incurred this year with George Marks, and we are providing for the portable village, which may or may not be necessary. Depends on how we approach these projects. But I think from a planning standpoint, it's important to think about that since the last several schools we've done, whether they be the replacement schools or the major HVAC projects, we've had to accommodate our students in portable villages. The dollars for Stark Elementary, that has not changed from the budget that we discussed previously. Similarly, Orange City Elementary, that's in the fifth year of your work program. That has not changed from the previous discussion. Spruce Creek High, this is a phased project, and some of these phases are going to be beyond your current five-year work program. This has changed from the last discussion in that it's been pushed back a little bit in order to address the other big projects. So those are the major changes, and
okay. Well, this is looking good. This is looking really good. I just so happy that we're in this economic situation that we're in right now, and it seems to be in the best interest of the use of our sales tax dollars to use them in this manner and get these projects going. I just want to say about New Smyrna Beach Middle School, FY 20 and 23. So that's the only one that looks like it's spread out over 3 years. Is that so? I guess that's a phase thing that you're.
That's a project similar to what we've done at Galaxy Middle and DeLand Middle with the HVAC ceiling and lighting interior renovations. And this is phased out a little bit longer than what we did for Galaxy and DeLand Middle. And once we get into the planning and those planning dollars are in fiscal year 20, if there's a way to consolidate that, we would. But it's really reflecting moving through the campus on a year-by-year basis right now. That's how it's laid out. That could get consolidated once we get into planning and design.
Okay, and I know you keep mentioning October as the month to, I guess, go out for the bond. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that's what we had. We used to be consistent with the dollars. You know, I think initially we were talking about needing to borrow sometime in February. I mean, needing the funds sometime in February. I know we've talked about maybe, you know, pushing that back a little bit to April, but to be consistent, we've just used that 10-1 October 19 borrowing date. But that's certainly flexible, and I know, you know, Jay would come back as well as our bond counsel. There's some technical paperwork, legal action that the board would need to take to lead up to that. So we would, I think it's about a three-month time span to complete all of that.
That might be a good kind of, you know, FYI for the school board members, because obviously today I think we're looking for some sort of direction to go prepare this financing, but you would definitely have it come back before you for approval of a school board resolution as well as a leasing corp resolution. So it's probably been a while. We've done some refunding transactions, but when we do COPS, you really wear two hats, and we'll have another chance to formally approve the financing at a subsequent meeting. And it probably will take us, you know, probably 90 days to get the financing papers together if that's the direction you want us to go at. So, you know, that October time frame is probably about as early as we could get the financing done. But we agree that we would not want to borrow the money before it's needed to be spent unless we think interest rates are going to rise, because you obviously, it's most important to lock in the long-term borrowing rate, the five-year borrowing rate at lowest rates possible. But I don't, you know, I probably said this before, if I knew what interest rates were going to go over the next 6 months or a year, I probably wouldn't be sitting here in front of you all. I'd be out on my yacht somewhere. But I don't think there's any indication rates are probably going up through the remainder of this year. What worries me is when you get into next year and you're in the heat of sort of the, you know, the 2020 presidential election and things like that, because those types of things, along with what we're doing with China and what we're doing with Mexico and Canada with trade wars and things like that, those things are really moving the market. And to date, those things have been favorable for the borrowing market. So as part of our job is to make sure if we see something coming that we think rates might be going up, we would come before you and say we might want to borrow this in October as opposed to, say, January or February. But all that would be to come sort of at a subsequent meeting.
Okay. Questions from the board? Ms. Haynes.
So the first time you came, it was $50 million. The next time you came, it was $75 million. Now it's $100 million. And is that based on the fact of Mr. Persis wanting Tomoka and Osceola to move up on new construction that we're now at $100 million?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So I guess I didn't realize when we met last time that, because the whole premise from day one with $50 million was all about Deltona Middle and the age of Deltona Middle and the condition of Deltona Middle. And we all, I think, agree that we need a new Deltona Middle. Somehow at the $75 million mark, I missed the fact that, you know, we could negotiate to move other schools around or place schools above other schools. And now we're here at $100 million. And, you know, I have been actually the person that's been against borrowing money because we didn't sell it to the community that we were going to use the sales tax money to borrow money. I'm happy with interest rate. I have nothing against interest rate. I'm still on the aspect we didn't sell the community we were going to borrow money. But I also didn't know that we were going to, like, negotiate. And, you know, I'm sitting here looking at this. And even that, at the last meeting, we looked at the age of our schools. And I believe age plays a part in schools and where they should fall. So I'm going to say this right now. I see Stark Elementary on here for $4 million in renovations. It wasn't that many years ago when we were building Citrus Grove Elementary that we were going to close Stark Elementary. And we treated Stark Elementary just the way we've treated the old Pearson Elementary. We're going to build a new school. We're building Citrus Grove. We're going to close Stark. We're going to rezone those children, and some of them are going to go to a brand new school, or they're going to go to a newer school. And we let Stark Elementary deteriorate, just as we did the old Pearson Elementary. We didn't keep up with it because nobody was going to be there. Then all of a sudden, surprise, surprise, because the principal led this whole community thing about don't lose your school, and we kept Stark Elementary open even though we had let it deteriorate. And to the best of my knowledge, unless I've missed something the last few years, we haven't really, we've patched things, we've duct taped things, we have not really put money into improving that school, and that is a very, very old school. It's actually older than Tomoka, okay? It's a very old school. And so what I see on here is, we're just going to patch it some more. We're going to do some more renovations. So my question is, why? Why are we treating schools differently? Why are we picking and choosing who gets a new school, which part of our community doesn't get a new school?
The projects that are listed are based on what's on the project list that was approved by the Citizens Committee and the board attached to the board's resolution for the sales tax. Does not mean that projects cannot change, but the descriptor that's in your package for Stark is based on what is listed on the half-cent project list.
It's one of our highest poverty schools. And I feel as if we turned our back on it several years ago, and we still have turned our back on that community.
Okay. I think the time for identifying all those schools was 2015, I think, perhaps, when the initial discussion was coming up. 2013. I'm sorry. Because the referendum was 2016, correct?
2014. August 26, 2014.
I don't think the tax went into effect until...
It went January of 2017. It
seems like we didn't... Yeah, thank you.
Because the difference between the referendum and when the collection started.
Oh, right, because the first one had to end.
Correct.
Okay, there we go. The first one was 2001 to 2016, and then we started again in January of 2017. Thank you for the correction. Miss Wright.
Just to bring everybody back, initially we wanted to borrow $150 million. That was the initial to cover all of this. and do it over a five-year period, and we said no. START was not on the initial list when they took tours of the school because during that time they were still debating if they were going to close START. So that is why it was not initially for a new construction. Now that we are here, and depending on the outcome of the instructions we give them now, I believe we probably need to look at what you're proposing and just see where some of this we may need to have a discussion. I do believe you're right, START is a very old school. But it started at $150 million. That I just wanted everybody to know. We didn't start at 50, we started at 150 to do as many projects as we could. The interest rate was not as favorable as it is today, so I do agree that, but I think we got to make some decisions, and we need to first decide if we want to bond, and if do, then we really do need to give directives to Sarah Lee. But keep in mind that when we went out, we never said to the community that we would not bond. We never said to the community that we would pay on a cash basis, because we had several builders and the builder organization who would have told you at that time, don't do that. I guarantee you they'd have said no bond because the shortage and the crisis we have right now with construction. So we didn't say how. We just laid out a plan, and they told us, based on their tour of the county, of the schools and facilities they felt that should be renovated or new construction should take place.
Yeah, good enough. Yes, Ms. Cuthbert.
My only concern, first of all, I'm in favor of bonding the $100 million. I'm a firm believer in the schools. We treat our schools all equally, and there's just so much money going around. New Smyrna Middle is 10 years older than Galaxy, and Galaxy was taken care of first. Most of the schools in my district are older. Spruce Creek High School needs a great deal of repair. It was built in the mid-70s. Creekside is probably the newest school, and it's already almost 20 years old. So, and of course, Chisholm is going to be brand new. So it's very important that we look at the cross-section of the county, and I do see the west side being addressed along with Deltona Middle. Two big schools, George Marks, is already in the works, but Deltona Middle is in desperate need of repair, and so does New Smyrna Middle. And I also see Orange City Elementary. There's I know there's a school in Ms. Wright's district that's very old, and that's Fort Orange Elementary. Anybody who has sat in those auditorium seats knows those auditorium seats need to, they creak enough. You can put a, you know, it's like sitting in a swamp in North Florida, all the crickets. But I think there's just only so much that we can do at a time, and it's very difficult to weigh one over the other. It's very difficult. So that's why I'm interested in the bonding, especially when we can invest some of the proceeds so we can make some money in order to pay our debt. It's only for 5 years. The only thing I have concern is, are we able to find the labor in order to make this happen for George Marks and Deltona Middle and New Smyrna Middle? Is there enough? Are we able to do that as a district
with you our mean company contractors or company personnel?
Well, both. How about both? Do we? Because I remember us saying beforehand we wanted to make sure we didn't lay off a lot of people, because mm-hmm. that was very painful for us mm-hmm. to do that beforehand.
Right. So I think over the course of certainly, whether we look at the five-year work program or the 11 remaining years of the sales tax, there's going to be some significant retirements within the facilities department. So I think, unlike last time, you know, some of staff attrition is going to be handled by aging. But regardless of whether we're talking internally or externally with the construction community, there is an overall concern about the labor market. There's plenty of articles written about that. That's not unique to us. As I mentioned previously, we were very pleased with the bid that we received for George Marks, which reflects the current market. And there was a lot of interest in that project from the subcontractor industry. I think about what Mr. Glover said in terms of, if I could predict where this economy will take us and how that will treat us, you know, I'd feel more comfortable making predictions. Right now, it appears that there's some stabilization. Whether that continues or changes, no one's sure. There's some conversation that things are going to change, you know, in 2020. For a number of different reasons, how that would influence the construction market might be favorable to us. We have noticed we still get good interest from solid companies in our projects. But certainly if I compared that level of interest to 15 years ago, it's different. And I think that is reflective of just there's not as much construction labor out there, and, you know, some companies are no longer with us. But we still do receive good attention, and the bids that we received for this summer's projects, we felt real good about, not just George Marks, the others. So I think Mr. Brown is here with me in the audience. He's our coordinator for construction. We've talked about manpower for these projects internally, because having a solid project manager on these projects is just as important as getting some good contractors. Pearson was our first project, and Pearson was the easy project. Everything after that is getting more and more challenging. And so one of the reasons we pushed Spruce Creek High out a little was because of internal management. And you've got some complicated, complex projects, and we need strong people on those. And that's not necessarily just somebody we hire.
Well, being part of the selection committee, I've seen, you know, firsthand the quality of people who come before us that we have to select from, and it's a wealth. I mean, they're fabulously quality companies, architects as well as construction companies. Even the small little company that's reworking the concrete at New Smyrna High, I mean, they're already doing, no, we'll take care of that for you. We'll take care of that for you, and not charging us anything extra. And it's refreshing to see that, because those gutters were all stuck up with plastic bottles. Kids would go on that top floor and dump them down the gutters. So, of course, kids are going to be children, but it's nice and refreshing to see the quality of work that is being done. And I'll tell you, the project manager at Chisholm is awesome. I mean, he's worth his weight in gold, platinum maybe. So I can see him going on after, and we've got another phase at Chisholm. Phase two is coming up this year, and I can see him going to another one of these other projects. So the people I've seen that I've worked with closely are really on top of everything. And it's already going to be 19-20. So the 21 and 22 are coming up very quickly. I think what Mrs. Haynes was commenting on, that Osceola jumped over Stark. Not even that?
No, it's just Stark's not even down. Stark was going to be closed. and probably those renovation costs there were to make it into a building that could be used for training or house district staff, because that was what the plan was. So we just let the school go, and we still have students there.
How do we know how many are at Stark? How many students?
Just under 400.
Under 400?
360. I'd have to look, but somewhere around there.
Okay. Okay, but I'm for the bonding.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Cologne.
And so, piggybacking off of that and not having been here when these conversations were taking place, I think that the question at hand is, do we borrow the money or not? And if what is being said about Stark is accurate, that it wasn't on the radar, then I think that we may need to go back and relook at the prioritization of these projects. That's something we can consider. I've never been to Stark, don't know what it looks like, so I'm ready to take a drive there and walk it just to see what we're talking about. But if it wasn't on the radar, then obviously it's not going to be on this list. So just, you know, I think there's two separate conversations there. But otherwise, you know, all of my schools in my district are old and they all need replaced. So I'm glad to see that Galaxy was done and Deltona Middle is going to happen, and I'm happy.
Your only school that's old other than Deltona Middle is Enterprise.
Established in 1800-something.
Yes.
Right. Something like that.
And we give you Enterprise.
Did you have a comment, Ms. Wright? I didn't know what.
I have a question.
Yeah, go ahead.
So, Sarah Lee, when we talk about the portable villages, do we own those portables or are we renting them?
With the exception of the portable village that we're doing at Deltona Middle, which we own, the ones we've done at Chisholm, Westside, DeLand Middle, George Marks, those are leased.
They're leased, okay. But once we finish the group that we're using at the school that belong to us, we will be using them at other sites, correct, to help reduce some of the cost.
The leased ones?
No, the ones that we own.
Oh, the ones that we own. When we can, yes.
Okay.
You know, we have a number of portables already at Deltona Middle. We're just relocating them out of the construction area. The biggest issue we have between portables we own and the ones we lease are the materials that they're constructed out of, and we need considerably more distance between portables for fire code with the ones we own. And so when we're dealing with these really tight campuses occupied, you know, it helps to tighten everything up. At Deltona Middle, we just happen to have quite a few on campus, and we're relocating them to the tennis court.
Okay. Thank you.
So I bring us back to the original project list of this sales tax initiative, and as I brought up the last time, it said we were going to replace at that time five schools: Pearson, Chisholm, George Marks, Deltona Middle, and Tomoka. Those were the only schools that were identified in 2013 as being replaced. Then there were major renovations, specific and significant renovations. And there's a list of schools: Enterprise, McGinnis, Orange City, Ortona, Osceola, Reed Patillo, Stark, and Woodward. Under Osceola, it has the most things listed. It's the only one that says new construction, administration, guidance, classrooms, windows and doors, exterior walls, site improvement, circuit. I mean, might as well, they should have just said a new school. But and I think then what happened was, so my question was, how did Osceola get ahead of Tomoka? And the answer was that Osceola is in really worse shape. I mean, it's as simple as that. So even though Osceola wasn't listed in the initial as a replacement school, when you look at everything they were going to do, it kind of says you're going to build a new school. So I think that's why where it is. I don't have any reservation about the committee or any group going to Stark and saying, do we need to spend more than $4 million? I mean, whatever that committee looks at and says we need to do, I think that's what we need to do. I'm not about wanting to be unfair to any of our schools. I want to do the right thing. And as far as this list, I think we're right on target with this list. And I'm in favor now of bonding. I believe, Ms. Wright, you've always been. Ms. Cuthbert, I think you've always been. Mr. Cologne, I think you were there because you wanted to get that Deltona Middle School built as soon as possible. So really, it was Ms. Haynes and I. We were the initial holdouts. But now when I see the financials on it, it just makes sense. To do it, and I guess the earliest we can do it is October 1st, if that's.
I would
what
say
I'm
that we were discussing schedule yesterday in a project team meeting for Deltona Middle, and I would encourage us to stick with the fall.
Okay, Ms. Haynes, yeah.
Okay, so we're still looking at starting. That we're not going to, I mean, I know what's happening with George Marks, but you kind of have the money for George Marks at the moment or enough to that you were able to start it. But we're still looking at not starting anything else till February, correct? So I ran all the numbers, and yes, the interest rates are good, and I have been the holdout about not doing it. I'm willing to move forward because of what the interest rates are and the fact that we can invest. But I still feel, you know, if at all possible, I would prefer not to borrow it earlier. I'd prefer to borrow it closer to the time we need it. I've listened to what you said about 2020 and all of that. You know, so is it unfeasible that we could still have the same low interest rates and we wait till December to borrow it, putting us closer to the time that you'll actually start to need to use the money in February, or?
Let me try to address that. Yeah, I mean, like I said, I don't think interest rates are going anywhere through this calendar year. What I would recommend doing is that if that's the desire, and it sounds like it's trending toward that way, is that we go back and we get the financing documents ready for you all to consider at a meeting that's probably like in the September time frame. But that does not obligate us to go out to the market immediately. That just gives us the flexibility to do so more quickly if we need to. So if we get approval in September and interest rates are not trending up or there's nothing happening that we see interest rates trending up, there's nothing stopping us from waiting until November or December to actually price the bonds. But if there's something economically that happens and we think rates are going up, we can still get into the market in October to kind of circumvent that. And we can obviously come back to you all to keep you all involved in that decision, but it just takes longer when we have to get on an agenda deadline and get the deal approved. So quite often, and we do this with refunding transactions quite frequently, we'll get approval as quick as possible, and then we wait to actually enter the market until the most opportune time. It just gives you the most flexibility. So if you all are comfortable with that, I would recommend us working toward like a September, October approval date with the flexibility to get into the market as soon thereafter or a month or two after that if we desire that.
Well, let me ask the board. Is there any board member that's not in favor of doing that? I don't see any. So, yeah, so we'll get the formalized process going as soon as you can. And then we'll really count on your expertise in terms of when would be the best optimum time to get into it. And if that's October or November or December, you know, that's what we'll do. Is that Okay. With every,
do we need a motion, Mr. Chair?
Well, we are in a... Yes. Oh, yeah, yeah, that's right. I thought for a minute, are we in a workshop or are we in a meeting? I don't even know anymore. So it's all kind of blending together, which is probably a good thing, actually. So, yeah, if someone would like to make that motion, Ms. Wright.
Mr. Chair, I move that we give our financial team and our staff instructions to move forward with proceeding with the bonding.
With the $100 million bond?
Yes.
Yes, okay.
I second.
That's a second. And further discussion or questions, clarification? Do you all need anything to ask us? You're all clear? All right. All those, we have a motion. We have a second. All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
And those opposed. And the motion carries unanimously. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank
Move
you.
Forward.
All right. Thank
Get
you.
Get us a low interest rate, you know, that we have to pay out and a high one that we come in. So that would be nice. All right. This has been great. I want to give Mr. Eggener, if the board is okay with that, just to give us a little update on anything. I know you've been with us now 16 hours or 20, so I know I don't mean to put you on the spot, but I know the board would love to hear from you.
No, thank you so much, and I'll be uncharacteristically brief, understanding where we are in the time of the week and the vacation coming up for many people. I did just want to follow up on a couple of items, and I won't go into detail because of the nature of the situation, but our agency clerk is recording all your questions. We're putting them into kind of a spreadsheet-type activity, and then she gives that to me, which I have been in receipt of. And the process is we're reviewing each question, who asked it, who needs to respond to it. Right now, all the questions that you asked about at the last meeting, I won't go through the list, but they will be answered at the workshop on the 25th. Mm-hmm. So you can expect your answers then. I like to make sure you have feedback as to if you've asked something, when you might hear about it. I also know, Ms. Haynes, you sent a separate email with a set of questions. Ms. Morrissey has responded to that, to your request, by saying we're working on it. Some of the questions you asked were contractual questions that we needed to consult the attorney on. So you two will get a response to each one of those as soon as it's complete. There was a request to post the appraisal. That has been posted, and I believe if you check your email, I'm looking over at Mr. Manning. Did we send out the email with that post, with that listed on it? Okay, if you have not received it, you will have evidence that was put on the public website. It's in Ms. Morrissey's area, but you'll have a link so you can actually see it. The only other thing I wanted to reference, and I thought it was very interesting that this wasn't topic number one, because this would usually be what I was talking about, but there's rumor that test scores came out. No, that's true. The test scores did come out. And I received several questions that I thought should be addressed publicly, so that there was real transparency with that. Many people think that those scores reflect a school grade which was transmitted to us. That is not the case. We have received only the raw scores. And so the raw scores give us evidence, and they give us a limited capacity to predict. Why is that? Because mobility and learning gains are not included in the raw scores, as well as other factors. So I'm not avoiding questions in regard to those scores. What I'm saying is that our team must go through, and we kind of do our own predicting based on mobility, learning gains, and the other factors that go into school grade. And the actual school grades won't come out until later in July. So I just wanted to make sure that everybody understood raw scores have come to us, and so our team has to analyze that, and that'll be done over the next couple of weeks. I can say that based on my view of the scores, I think the proactive actions that were taken last year were on the right track in how to address some of these issues. I have also asked some of the department to review other districts and see where we fell, like if we had a general trend down with most schools, how did other districts fare in that area? I've been in this business long enough to know that sometimes you have drops that are peculiar only to your system or a few schools. Those are real red flags. You have other red flags. It's like, whoa, 23 other districts had similar drops in the same area. So does this reflect the changes in the tests that take place on an annual basis, you know, the vagaries of that kind of assessment? So we're actually analyzing that as well. So you'll be given greater detail as soon as that detail is available.
Thank you. Yes, Ms. Cuthbert.
AP scores come out on Friday, July 5th. Will we be receiving those scores?
You know, I would like to say yes, but I don't know. I don't know how we transmit scores here at this time. I hate to admit that. But that generally was a report that was summarized, what the culture I'm used to, and our assessment team members are not here today. So I would hate to tell you something I can't deliver, but I will get a response back to you.
All right. Thank you.
Ms. Haynes.
So, Mr. Egner, you referenced the email that I sent. And when I joined the school board in November, we went to training the last week of November, 1st of December. And in the training, they shared with us that if we sent an email asking a question, that the response would be shared with all board members so that all board members could see what question or questions we asked and see what the response was. Well, so far, there's been a practice I've noticed that when I ask questions, sometimes even here at the board meeting, I will sometimes receive an email with the answers, but the other board members will not be on it. And then I've had to nicely ask, well, could you share that information with them? I'd really like to know what the protocol is moving forward, because if I ask a question, I'm asking and I'm not asking for the information just to come to me. I'd like for everyone to see it. Or, you know, if Ms. Cuthbert asks something, I may have the same type of question and she gets an answer and then, you know, I'm asking again, which is then taking more time away from staff. So I would just like to request that if any one of us ask a question, specifically, like even addressing what I asked about, that when that information comes, could it just be shared with all of us and we know that everybody got it, and then we don't have to go back and say, well, could you please now share this with the other board members or whatever, because I'm asking a question that I think everyone would, you know, want to know the answer to.
The answer to your question is I don't know what past practice is at this time. I will tell you that I'm used to a culture in which if a board member puts a question in writing, which in essence is public information, that set of questions would be answered and sent to all board members. So I have no problem whatsoever either directing that or, as in today, checking to make sure I'm not violating any vagaries of statute that I don't understand. However, what I want to make sure, I like to fine-tune this so I don't make a mistake. If someone calls me as an individual and asks a question, I would not want to automatically turn that into a message that goes to everyone. And I'd like Mr. Manning to come forward and try to help address this in a more formal way.
Good afternoon, board members, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Superintendent. My concern from a legal perspective, and Mr. Dorn can go into this further, for the board members would be potential sunshine violation. And where I could see that is if a board member, in addition to asking a question, is expressing an opinion about something that may come up before you all to vote in the future. And then if that is then shared with the other board members is where you could get into a sunshine issue. It's somewhat difficult to make a blanket statement in every case could happen. Now, the response, I suppose, could be shared, but it may not be particularly useful without having the question as well. So it does somewhat become a...
So the email that Mr. Egner referenced, I know what I wrote in that email, and I would have no problem with the answers coming back to the questions, and you can remove my final, you know, statement off of that when you share the answers with everyone else. I think you'd have to share the questions so that they know what, you know, this is what we're answering. But I'll use another example. At a previous meeting, I asked for the number of instructional staff that's under the instructional bargaining unit that we currently have in Volusia County that were not assigned to a classroom. And Mrs. Paige Pender sent me that list, but she sent it only to me, even though I asked in a board meeting. So I wrote back and just said, would you please share this with all board members? I mean, they heard me ask the question. There was no opinion in that. She just answered it. And so I didn't know why I then had to say, would you share it? And so, because it was asked in public, and I think it's something that everybody would want
yes.
to know.
Mr. Eggner.
The nuance is important that Mr. Manning's identifying, and my language when I said what I said was, when you ask a formal question in a written form, we can answer the questions. The idea of if the formal questions are listed along with opinion, and this is hypothetical, but I need an answer to this or I'm going to vote no next time, is the kind of thing Mr. Manning's concerned about. And if I were asked to censor the document that you sent, not sending it out as it came to me, then that creates issues for me, because then it changes the nature of the intent of the communication. So I think what Mr. Manning is explaining is that if you want a process whereby you can inquire specific questions that are not attached to personal opinions, any hint of your perspective on a current or future board item, et cetera, then yes, we can answer those and send them right out. But if there's any reflection of what could be your hint to other people that could be your vote next time, then we would be in violation. And I would like not only Mr. Manning to review what I just said to make sure I'm not wrong, but also Mr. Dorn to see if we're on the right track with that.
Mr. Dorn.
Well, we've beat this horse pretty dead. But, yes, I mean, the key is that it just be a question. And I think maybe the way to deal with it is if the question comes forward and staff or I have always had a practice. Any of you ask me a question for information, I distribute it to everybody, even though nobody knew you asked. Okay? Here, everybody knows pretty much because you're asking an open session. But I think the practice that we should employ, which fits the concerns, is if staff or Mr. Eggner sees a question that includes what he is concerned about being some sort of statement of an opinion, maybe just send it back to you and say, we're going to provide you this information, but if you want it disseminated, please send us a new email. And everybody understands that, right?
Yeah, that's simple.
And,
yeah.
And it's pretty simple.
Just ask the question.
Yeah, just ask the question. And then if you want to communicate with Mr. Eggner about opinion, you can do that. You know, once you get the information, you could write back and say, you know, I have real concerns about this, and blah 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 blah, and not include other board members
yeah.
in that. Right?
Thank you. That's perfect. That's perfect. Yes, Ms. Cuthbert.
We have a unique situation coming up. It's a holiday Thursday, and district is closed on Friday. We have a 4-day weekend.
Oh.
Yeah.
District's
closed
Friday,
correct?
It is actually what I should, I'll be really transparent with my theme. The non-work day was moved to Thursday. So this week, it's a 4-day week, but the week off for staff is on Thursday. However, I would say that there's about 98% of the staff who are also taking Friday off. So that was why I equivocated on getting you a quick answer. It's because
nobody here.
In my mind, I'm trying to think, when is he getting back? When did she leave? And so I think there's a great likelihood that we're going to have not be able to count on the right people being able to answer the question correctly. And I want to be responsive to questions, but I'd rather give you an accurate answer than a fast answer. So as soon as I'm sure who's here, and most of these people work on the weekends anyway, and I'm taking calls on Friday, and we're doing things. But the reality is I don't want to count on that. And so it would be you know, sometime next week before I could really be sure that I'm going to get good answers.
It's just a wonderful opportunity. It doesn't usually happen
for a
four-day weekend. And also my last comment is to wish Ms. Wright bon voyage, have a safe trip, get back safely.
Long trip there, Ms. Wright. Ms. Haynes, yes.
Okay, so with that being said about a lot of the district staff being gone on Friday, I do want to put in a plug that yesterday all of our summer programs started out at our sites.
That's right.
And our summer programs are still happening on Friday. So with district staff being gone, there are still all high schools, all middle schools, and 12 elementary schools that will have summer programs in session on Friday because they started yesterday. And they get Thursday off, but they have to come back on Friday. So I don't want anybody to think that there's no one working on Friday.
You know, while you were talking, we were talking about sunshine stuff. It just dawned on me, how many of you were planning on going to that faith meeting? There's a faith meeting coming up July the 9th, I think it is, and I think you are going.
Yeah, it's on my calendar.
Amy Hall and myself. I didn't know whether you all were going, because if there were more than one of us going, again, that's another issue.
They reached out for individual meetings, but not.
Yes. Okay. We weren't told about the 9th.
Okay. All right. Well, I just thought if you were, perhaps think again about going so that we don't get in the violation of anything. Okay. Everything's good there. Yes, Mr. Cologne.
One of the things I wanted to bring up, since we do have a little bit of time, one of the sessions that we visited at the School Board Association meeting dealt with the census. And a young lady from South Florida did a great presentation on the census, the importance of the census, and the impact we can have on the census. This year, there's a lot of dollars that are not being tied to the census. And so folks specifically in South Florida are getting very creative. And one of the things that they've done is they've added to their logo for the rest of the year, be counted or ser contado, either way, to their logo. So I do have that presentation. The young lady sent it to me, and I'll share it with Superintendent. Just something to put in our radar. I've reached out to the county. They're talking about getting a group together. I've reached out to the representative. They're talking about getting a group together, but nothing finite has been set. And so I believe Representative Santiago is talking about leading that on the west side of town. Barb's gave me a phone number to somebody in Atlanta, but the county really hasn't done a whole lot in that avenue. And so I think that's something we could definitely have an impact in, letting folks know between now and next April. So I'll forward that presentation to you as well. That's it.
Good point, Anyone else have any comments, Ms. Wright?
Just put something on our website, or a reminder or a link or something about the census, because it is very important.
Absolutely.
Public education.
Oh, yes, so true. Well, I want to wish everyone a very happy 4th of July. Leave the fireworks to the professionals. Let's all come back with our fingers and toes.
On the
22nd. And we do have a meeting on July 22nd. Remember, folks, we have the workshop first with the Florida School Board Association, and then whatever other staff workshops are going to piggyback that one. I think we're counting on maybe 2 hours with FSBA, I think. And then we'll see what happens after that. So, and then we have a school board meeting, right? And does that start at 2 on that Monday?
Yes,
it starts at 2.
And we have two more items added after the
Yeah, after the original. And then we have the budget hearing on the 23rd at 5:30. Okay? That's it. Have a safe holiday, everyone. We adjourn.
Go USA.
Go USA. Yeah, they're playing now.